continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Amandla is your 1 hour show of African news and analysis, and I am sitting in my kitchen and Doug is sitting in his office as we continue to produce the pandemic edition of Amandla. So tonight, sadly, it's going to be a rest in peace to somebody who was very beloved, still is, and is very much going to be missed, and that's Bell Hooks, who passed away last week. We were very shocked by the news. She was still a very young woman and such a critical Black feminist voice, activist, teacher, anti-imperialist. Anyway, we've pulled together a little excerpt of an interview that she gave back in 1995 that I think wonderfully illustrates her intersectional approach to liberation and justice. So we'll be paying tribute to Bell Hooks tonight.
I, on the other hand, playing the concluding part of the panel that GRILA, the Group for Research for Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa, Toronto Division, or Toronto Group, set up to discuss China-Africa relations, current state, challenges, and perspectives. It was a panel that brought together some very interesting panelists. Not everybody was singing the same song. And at the same time, it really opened eyes to what's going on that issue. And so this is it for our last edition of 2021.
Oh, that's true.
Stay tuned to Amandla.
Mississippi Goddam is our last tune. We had some requests for it. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's got me so upset, and Governor Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam. Hound dogs on my trail. School children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path. I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on the land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know. They keep on saying, go slow. That's just the trouble.
Do so.
Washing the windows.
Do so.
Picking the cotton.
Do so.
We're just plain rotten.
Do so.
We're too damn lazy.
Do so.
I'm thinking's crazy.
Do so.
Where am I going? What am I doing? I don't know. I don't know. Just try to do my very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. Picket lines, school boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. You lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady, and you'd stop calling me Sister Sadie. My country is full of lies. We are all gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust nobody anymore. They keep on saying go slow. That's just the trouble. Desegregation. Mass participation. Unification. Do things gradually.
Welcome back to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal and CQT.ca. So the world lost an intellectual giant, an important popular voice, and a committed activist last week. Bell Hooks passed away on December 15th. She was an outspoken Black feminist scholar, educator, and activist who brought us a critical and thought-provoking voice to issues of race, gender, imperialism, educational practices, and much more. And she was a guide to so, so many of us. There's a lot out there for you to listen to. She gave generously of her time and used her various academic residencies in the States to facilitate and engage in conversations with other academics and activists. They're all out there for you to listen to, and I really encourage you to do so. I listened to a lot of them in preparation for the show tonight, and she's just incredibly inspiring and instructive and, yes, a guide. So tonight we're going to play a brief interview she gave with Charlie Rose on PBS all the way back in 1995, right after she'd released her book, Killing Rage, Ending Racism. It's an older piece, but I chose it because in the 9 short minutes, I think it really brings out her intersectional approach with clarity and eloquence. Here now is Bell Hooks.
White supremacy, first of all, isn't a white thing. It's part of this culture. It's part of how all of us have been taught to think about difference, who's better, who's inferior, who's superior. I prefer white supremacy to racism precisely because it says that we're all being socialized to think along certain dualistic lines, and that the notion of that which is light or white being better, that which is dark or black being worse, bad, inferior, is something that everyone in the culture is socialized to think.
I'm going to speak about some political events and some recent events first, and two things you know I want to talk about, or three things actually. First is the Million Man March. What'd you think?
Well, the Million Man March was something that I deeply and profoundly opposed. I opposed it because I'm not one of those people who thinks you can separate messages from the messengers. I think that while the idea of Black male solidarity and unity is a fine idea, just as who could not be moved by the images of all of those men? But underlying those images is a political ideology, is a way of thinking about family. I mean, just the other night I was giving a lecture at Dartmouth and some young Black men were saying, but how can it be wrong for Black men to oppose welfare? And I said, well, it's one thing to say that Black men should assume responsibility for families, and another thing to look realistically at our job and employment situation and to say, what would actually happen to many single-parent households that women head if, in fact, there was not aid to assist women in a process of change and transition, many of whom are hoping for jobs that don't exist?
what ideology, back to what you were saying in terms of message and the messenger, what ideology do you believe was being promulgated? Was it the Nation of Islam?
No,
or
actually,
was it some other ideology?
I would say that first and foremost, it was patriarchy. I mean, when someone tells me in their mission statement that no nation sends its women to war while the men sit in the kitchen, and, you know, the situation of race in America right now is like war, you know, and the men are going to Washington, that to me is a real gendered dialogue about conventional masculinity, which denies a history of race relations where the engagement of black women in resistance struggle has been so meaningful and so crucial.
Would it have been less effective, as effective, or much more effective if women had been part of it?
Let me go on record as saying, Charlie, I have no trouble if men want to march by themselves.
Yeah.
I feel like men could march for days by themselves, and I'd sit at home and cook and clean if they were marching for principles and values and politics that would actually aid black self-determination. I happen to think that patriarchy has been deadly for the planet and for black men.
Okay, perhaps it has, but who says that they were marking for patriarchy? I mean, that's what not sure
well, I mean,
that
that's
I
why
don't
we have
I'm
to
not
listen
sure that
to...
was the if you talk to all those people that were there, which I didn't, but I've talked to people who did talk to them and wander through the crowd without television cameras and had lots of conversations, and it didn't seem to be a patriarchy. It seemed about responsibility, and it seemed to be about some sense of self-esteem, and it seemed to be about fathers and sons and fathers and daughters.
But that sense of responsibility was connected to particular notions about the family, not about self-responsibility first, but it was the idea that, in fact, the old idea that men acquire self-esteem by the degree to which they can be providers and protectors. That is what patriarchy says to us. And what we know is that a lot of men provide, a lot of men protect, and they still have difficulties with self-esteem.
Have black women, in your judgment, endorsed feminism and responded to it?
Well, in Killing Rage, I try to talk about the fact that that black women have questioned feminism because of our recognition that race is always a factor. So there's been a calling attention to racism within the women's movement, particularly the racism of privileged class women who were saying, you know, we're victimized because of certain issues that black women did not see as an occasion for victimization.
Did it put black women against white women then?
Yes, I think the core reformist-based feminist movement very much pitted black women against white women by the fact that the discourses of women of color and black women were left out. For example, the early on, a major thesis of feminism was women need to get out into the workforce.
Right.
Well, masses of black women were already into the workforce and weren't liberated.
Masses of poor women were already
Absolutely.
Out of the workforce.
And that kind of work, who is it liberating for? So there was a real distinction between those women Betty Friedan was describing as sitting at home, many of whom were well-educated, had been educated in the Ivy League or the Seven Sisters, you know, and weren't doing anything, and those masses of women who were in factories, who were, you know, cleaning people's homes, who did not see work as central to liberation, and who were, in fact, fantasizing about the days of their lives when they wouldn't have to work. So there's a chapter in Killing Rage about black and white female relations where I say, until our relationships improve, until black women and white women understand each other better, there will not be an end to racism in this society.
O.J. Simpson, what do you think? I mean, about the... not so much... obviously, I'm fascinated by whether people thought he was did it or not. But beyond that, are you surprised by the reaction to it?
I was deeply surprised and troubled by the reaction to it because I feel like I was one of the people who religiously tried not to watch the case precisely because I felt in respect to the fact that this was a case rooted in domestic violence. Here again, I don't think that people can pretend that in fact somehow the domestic violence doesn't matter. This tragedy would not have happened if male violence against women was not so acceptable in our culture. Because there is a line leading up to the tragedy. Whether we know who murdered this woman or not, we do know that a whole life that was structured around acceptance of violence was a part of how this couple related to one another. And that, to me, made me feel like once this becomes entertainment, once the camera is focused on O.J. Simpson, people will forget that at the heart of this is both male violence and male violence against women, because we've not heard anybody speculate that a group of women were outside that house chopping up anybody. So clearly, we cannot get away from the dilemma of male violence in our culture and male violence against women. And I try to hold to that as a way of not deflecting attention away from the fact that this was not an issue of race. I mean, that the case itself was not an issue of race. How we interpret it, how we witness it as a culture, it was racialized, but the heart of it still, for me, remains male violence against women.
And but what about those, including Johnny Cochran, I guess, who would say, no, it was about race, because it was about race, and it's because of the attitude of the LAPD.
Well, I think, one, even before we knew anything about the attitude of the LAPD, we know that whenever sexuality is involved and gender in our culture, people often prefer to talk about race. Race is easier for people to, it's easier to racialize something, because if we make it a case of gender, we have to see a man like O.J. Simpson as very empowered by class and by patriarchy. If we make it a case of race, we can see him as always and only a victim. And so, of course, it was very important for men in general, and Cochran in particular, himself, you know, according to his ex-wife, someone who is no stranger to domestic violence, to act as though the only issue here is one of racial injustice.
Bell Hooks' Killing Rage, Ending Racism. This is a collection of essays about a whole range of subject matter having to do with men and women and gender and violence and rage and a lot of other things. My friend Cornel West says, unlike most black intellectuals, she writes with a sense of urgency about the existential and psychocultural dimensions of African-American life, especially those spiritual and intimate issues of love, hurt, pain, envy, and desire, usually probed by artists. Her books help us not only to decolonize our minds, soul, and bodies, on a deeper level, they touch our lives. It is difficult to read a Bell Hooks essay or text without enacting some form of self-examination or self-inventory, which is exactly what she would like for you to do. Thank you.
My skin is black. Arms are long. My hair is woolly. My back is strong. Strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah. My name is Aunt Sarah. Aunt Sarah. My skin is yellow. My hair is long. Between two worlds, I do belong. My father was rich and white. He forced my mother late one night. What do they call me? My name is Sophronia.
That piece of music you just heard was Nina Simone singing Four Women. The piece before the Bell Hooks tribute was again Nina Simone singing Mississippi Goddamn. And I thought Nina was a perfect a bookend to a wonderful, a powerful political person like Bell Hooks, a tribute. So I'm just going to now remind you that you're listening this time to the last part of the panel discussion by Grilla from Toronto. Grilla, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa. You can get them at grila.org. And the International Manifesto Group sponsored this panel and brought together a variety of very interesting folks with really good knowledge of what China's about, as compared to what you're getting off the mainstream media. So the two last speakers are on tonight, and then a small summary by the host, Amit Lo, an old comrade of Amandla's. He does a nice summary of the discussion at the very end. So that's, stay tuned to China, Africa Relations, Current State, Challenges and Perspectives.
Christine Pleist is a member of the Toronto chapter of GRILA. Is a professor of sociology at the University of Toronto. She's a co-author of a book called Capitalism and Its Uncertain Future, and also the author of a book called Brewing Resistance, Indian Coffee House, and the Emergency in Post-Colonial India. Christine, you have the floor.
Thank you so much, Amit. So hello, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us for this very important conversation on Africa-China relations. And thanks so very much to Amit and to John for organizing. My comments for today are largely a product of study sessions that Grilla Toronto held to think through these issues as a collective, but I will also incorporate some of my own thoughts. So I want to begin today on the question of cooperation and development, given that this phrase is in the title of the event. The central hinge in this conversation, in my view, is should we celebrate the contemporary relationship between African states and China as in the genre of South-South development that the Global South dreamed of in the mid-20th century, or are contemporary Africa-China relations a new imperialist dynamic emerging through the crisis of US hegemony as China assumes the role of an emerging world power? As Vijay Prashad elucidates in The Darker Nations, the third world is not a place, but a political project. In the mid-20th century, at the height of US hegemony, the Global South imagined political, economic, and social emancipation. One important incarnation of this, as was mentioned by Amit in the introductions to this event today, was the Bandung Conference in 1955, where representatives of 29 newly independent Asian and African states met to promote what's now termed South-South cooperation. In other words, the idea that African and Asian states could come together for economic and cultural cooperation and together oppose colonialism and imperialism. Bandung, as we mentioned earlier, was institutionalized in the Aligned Movement, but the Non-Aligned Movement was not without its critics. So Muammar Gaddafi famously said of the Non-Aligned Movement that the world is made up of two camps, the liberation camp and the imperialist one. There's no place for those who are non-aligned, who are not neutral and totally aligned against the aggressor. And as Gaddafi saw it, the Global South was not comprised of states who are beholden to US imperialism on the one hand, states beholden to Soviet imperialism on another, and then the states that opposed either influence. In Gaddafi's assessment, there were only two states, those who were against imperialism and for liberation, and others that were imperialist or dominated by imperialism. So our understandings of contemporary imperialism, however, are shaped by the lived experience of the 20th century of US hegemony and the particular way in which it supplanted European colonial rule with new dependent relationships of exploitation of the same character, but through new forms of politico-economic relationships between the United States and the Global South. But with the crisis of US hegemony starting in the 1970s, and now with a more pronounced global crisis since 2008 of perhaps the capitalist world system itself, imperialism as we know it will also necessarily change. forms of power and hierarchy need to be remade so that they can continue on as they lose moral authority. The United States has lost its moral authority for global rule, providing openings for a new hegemonic power to emerge and to lead the world economy in overcoming the current crisis. For example, the transition from British hegemony in the 19th century to US hegemony in the 20th, we see imperialism persist, but the form it took changed. Formal colonialism lost its moral authority, which led to the important development of flag independence across much of the global South. But in this absence of formal political rule through colonialism, the United States innovated new articulations of imperialism during the Cold War and beyond. Any new hegemon, as part of its rule, must convince the rest of the world that it is acting in the best interests of the interstate system. Part of the establishment of that consent to rule entails forming dependent relationships with the Global South that appear to be in the best interests of the Global South. With the rise of a new world hegemon, imperialism must necessarily be remade to look like aid, cooperation, and solidarity. This helps the rising hegemon establish a global moral authority as it appears to be acting in the moral interests of the entire world economy. In these phases of world history where a new hegemon is on the rise, it's critically important that we can distinguish between true South-South cooperation that has the potential for national liberation from a new incarnation of imperialism in its guise. When we examine this distinction between South-South cooperation on the one hand and contemporary imperialism from the perspective on the ground, it's critically important to understand local political conditions that can create an imbalance of power. Therefore, we must better understand the contemporary dynamics of African sovereignty. While the 21st century began with revolutions to oust decades of post-colonial authoritarian rule in places like Egypt, Tunisia, Sudan, and elsewhere, these efforts were short-lived. Counter-revolutionary forces, particularly those led by right-wing nationalists and conservative religious leaders, too often became the eventual beneficiaries of movements that toppled authoritarian regimes. And in recent years, we've witnessed more counter-revolutions and coups across the African continent. In Chad, for example, states succumbing to authoritarianism has become more prevalent, and we seldom observe revolutions that have been successful at installing long-lasting democratic states committed to promoting the interests of African people. In this fraught context of authoritarian rule across the continent, it's been easier for imperialists to usurp African sovereignty. Just as European and North American states have found authoritarian rule in Africa more amenable to their political economic interests, so too has China. In Zambia, for example, copper mining accounts for 65% of the country's export earnings. Most of the mines are owned by the Chinese state, though few are mining companies with headquarters in Canada. Foreign mining companies have been able to create pockets of Chinese state sovereignty within Zambia, where labor laws are notoriously lax, wages low, accidents and deaths of workers prevalent. When workers have protested these conditions, they've been met with violence, not from the Zambian state, but from Chinese management, who's met workers' demands by deploying violence without consequence. Another example would be the Lamu project to build a deep water port connecting East Africa to Asian export markets, which was initially funded by the Kenyan, Ethiopian, and South Sudanese states. But because of funding issues and occasional attacks on port construction by Al-Shabaab, Kenyan defense forces sought loans from China, which were supported through the Maritime Silk Road Program, which is a policy not only to aid China in gaining further access to African resources and markets, but also to enable the People's Liberation Army Navy to establish a counterterrorism base in northern Kenya. Ports are crucial to African development, as 90% of East African exporters depend on seaports to remain viable. But if Kenya defaults on the debt they've incurred, which seems likely, the Lamu port will soon become yet another space of Chinese state sovereignty in sub-Saharan Africa. Land grabbing through creating pockets of Chinese state sovereignty and through control of strategic assets has helped China obtain cheap natural resources needed for industrial production, while railroads, other infrastructure, along with access to seaports, allows for the extraction of these resources from sub-Saharan Africa. regime change has not been successful in disrupting this dynamic because the movements for regime change have mostly focused on ousting political leaders. But as a result of European and North American imperialism, and also through the support of the domestic bourgeoisie, sovereignty in most African states rests with the military. Recent revolutions have done little to disrupt this or to create states that will serve the interests of the people. Since the mid-20th century, the most commonly proposed left solution to neocolonialism and imperialism has been delinking. In this era of globalization, however, we've seen, especially during the pandemic, that cutting off Africa's ties to the global economy can hurt the very people delinking tends to liberate. Yet there's a difference between globalization done on the terms of more powerful states and a horizontal internationalism based on solidarity. Africa-China relations in and of themselves could bring great benefit to both regions, but as long as there remains a power differential in African states' individual dealings with China, it will remain a tie that will ultimately result in economic benefit for China and the exploitation of Africa. One possible solution could be to have negotiations around Chinese development projects in African states done as a regional bloc through a Pan-African Union rather than country by country. But beyond this, what we as an internationalist left can do is decenter the role of the state in Africa-China relations. If civil society and leftist groups in both China and across the African continent could work together across borders, it could put pressure on states to realize common social injustices in both China and in various African contexts, such as the importance of opposing authoritarian regimes that fail to serve the best interests of the people, and promoting workers' rights through a labor internationalism. We can also envision linkages between other Chinese and Pan-African civil society organizations around common issues that are relevant to both the African and Chinese contexts. Frantz Fanon famously described the Third World Project, as he called it, as a rejection of the goal of catching up to Europe and North America, and instead saw its primary goal to innovate a new way of thinking. Fanon believed in the creativity of the revolutionary leftist Global South, that new forms of politics could be envisioned and enacted that would provide solutions to longstanding social problems. There's a tendency within the global North left to see any political development that opposes Western dominance as something to celebrate. But in thinking through the complexity of contemporary Africa-China relations, it's evident that we need to be more discerning about the dynamics of power involved in the movements that may claim to be South-South cooperation and/or anti-Western. They may yet be an embodiment of the unequal power dynamics and politico-economic exploitation we stand firmly against. Propaganda, as many of esteemed colleagues have mentioned, coming from the West, but also from China, obscures the power dynamics at play on the ground in Sino-African relations. The ability of propaganda to muddy our understanding of the dynamics at play makes organizing around these issues particularly difficult and controversial. But we need to remember, as leftists based in Canada or anywhere else for that matter, that just because something is anti-West doesn't make it automatically liberatory. So we need to be thoughtful and discerning about how we think about power and history in our contemporary context. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the conversation and questions.
Thank you so much, Christine, for your presentation. And we're going to move to the last panelist, Pablo Edhoza, who is a professor of African Studies at York University here in Toronto, with a specialty in national development and modernity in Africa. He is the author of a book called The Norms of Displacement, NGO, Globalization, and the State in Africa. Pablo, you'll have a mic.
Good evening, good afternoon, and good morning to everyone. And my thanks to John and to Ahmed, as well as Radhika, for coordinating this event, this international event, and to all my co-panelists, whom I've learned a great deal from, and who in many ways have kind of taken the sustenance out of much of what I wanted to say. But nonetheless, I'll also use in some ways, so my thanks to Daniel, to Huang, to Kabiyomi, to all the others, I'm sorry, for their presentations. And there are really three things that I want to say, in part drawing from what others have said, but also in some sense my own take on much of this debate. One of the things I was actually going to talk about was soft power, and the degree to which soft power can become a means through and by which government states' powers can influence countries in different ways. And whilst on the one hand I'm both thankful and mindful of what Huang said about the extraordinary ways in which China has reconfigured and reshaped how we knowledge is produced and knowledge is understood and knowledge is situated, we don't want it to become another form of the British Council or the Alliance Française in terms of, in some sense, reconsolidating the ways in which soft power is used to reinforce people's understandings of different places. But that's not my primary concern here. My primary concern is really twofold. One is, once again, to reinforce the different conceptions or understandings of imperialism and not colonialism, or to differentiate the two, we might say, moments. It doesn't seem to me that Chinese is a colonial power, but as somebody pointed out, it is part, in some sense, of a contestation over the ways in which the conduits of resources are utilized in different parts of the world. And in some ways, that is part of colonialism, but it's also part of an imperial project to consolidate power and rule. The second point I wanted to make really is the issue about development. It's been brought up that China has been, in a sense, a different model of understanding how development takes place throughout the globe. And about that, I would agree. And some of it has to do, of course, with the way in which China has a hands-off approach, we might say, to the ways in which development elites in different African countries pursue their goals. And it has to be said, and this goes back to what Daniel said, we have to give African states and the agents within states their own agency. It's not all one way. But nonetheless, we do have to have some sets of measures as to how, one, we understand the process of how development has been improved in the short term, and we might say in the long term. And secondly, whether or not China in different ways consolidates one aspect of, we might say, imperial or imperialist rivalry. So I'm going to link these in a very unoriginal way, which has been used by a number of, we might say, mainstream political economists. And that's to look at, in some sense, the direct and indirect effect of China's role in Africa as a site of measurement, right? So that we're not constantly engaged in this kind of epiphenomenal understanding of the impact of Chinese involvement in Africa. If I can just give two quick examples of that before I move on. One is a personal one from a friend of mine who's a Congolese, who made the point that throughout the history of colonialism under the Belgians, and then subsequently under the French and the Americans, that no road had been built from his village to the main regional city where he's from. The first road that was ever built was by the Chinese. Now, most people would say that's a good instance and a good illustration of a form of development that is not linked to the kind of instrumentalism that characterized a great deal of infrastructural development under colonialism. That is to say, roads were only built to the extent they facilitated colonial trade. This appears to be an instance of China engaging in infrastructural development in and of itself because it benefits a local population. And I would support that both as an illustration of, we might say, intrinsic development in and of itself, and we might also say soft power as a form of identifying a certain kind of doing things differently. The second is a recent series of problems in a country that just recently had an election in Gambia, where a plant that has been built by China for the purpose of essentially fish feed for Chinese farms elsewhere, right? So a great deal of local fish food is used for the purpose of putting this into fish farms in places as different as the Sudan, as well as in China. And some of the extraordinary polluting effects that have come from this, right? So this is one illustration of a particular company in China that is linked to the Chinese state, which has deleterious effects upon a local economy, yet at the same time is increasing the GDP of Gambia itself. So we're caught between these two tensions. On the one hand, where we have what one might call an example of the direct effect of Chinese investment in a particular place.
This is to let you know or remind you that you're listening to a webinar panel organized by GRILA, on China, Africa relations, current state, challenges and perspectives. We're bringing this to you from Amandla Radio here at CQT 90.3.
The issue for us, however, is broader. There are two parts of this. One, the broad effect, which is how do we understand this in the context of the overall impact of Chinese investment in Africa. So we need to disaggregate some of the figures that, for example, were issued earlier by Barry and by Daniel, right? So we need to break that down and not just have these global figures that say, here are this investment, here are these terms of trade, this is good, this is better than what happens in the West. The West is not the measure, nor should be the measure, or the only measure by which we assess whether China does well or not. One can say that the environmental impact upon these local communities, particularly upon these coastal communities, is devastating. At the same time, macroeconomically, we can say without equivocation that there have, in fact, been value added to the Gambian economy. It's these kinds of tensions that I think people need to understand. And this gets back to Christian's point about the mode of development in different kinds of places. So what I'm going to do now is to just, in a sense, finish off to talk about the different ways in which we can understand. And there are really six areas. One is trade, right? What is the nature of the growth of exports to China, right? Is it negative? What are the displacements that take place in this trade? Are producers displaced from China? What about FDI projects? What is the nature of the inflows into different parts of Africa? And we need to disaggregate, right? Because South Africa is not the Gambia. Egypt is not Lesotho, right? So we need to have some understanding of Africa as a whole, but we also need to understand the local specific context within which these FDI flows and these technologies take place. So do Chinese firms displace local industries? And if so, what is the take-up from that? Is there greater employment? Is the nature of that employment in any ways improved? Is there greater integration into global markets where there's value added for China, for African products? Or can we say that there's a diversion from these places that benefits OECD countries and which also favors China's, right? Let's take a look at finance. What's the nature of that additional finance? Many of the panelists today have talked about the differentiating nature of finance. And it's clear that the nature of the financial relationship between China and Africa and what existed, certainly through international agencies like the World Bank and the IMF, and the bilateral agencies of Europe and the global north, are very, very different in many ways than what China's had on offer. But even here, one needs to understand what is the nature of those additional resources in finance and where do they go? Are they unsustainable? Do they increase indebtedness? Once again, rather than have those global figures, one needs to look at how they have an impact specifically on given countries and what the nature of the relationship between those countries and China is. One can talk about the social, right? We've already talked about the about employment and increased employment. Is employment created? Let's take, for example, one instance of this that's unequivocal. 25,000 people were employed by China in the Mombasa to Nairobi train development, right? A fantastic infrastructure project. That's not only about Kenya, but it's also about the region as a whole, both those beyond Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and so on. So here we have an infrastructure project that's unequivocally of benefit to regional investment, trade overall. And also, of course, that it provided employment, one of the consequences of which is going to have a multiplier effect upon the economy overall, right? So this is an example then that has not just an economic impact, but a broader social impact that's going to have all these different kinds of changes throughout the economy. But there are also instances of displacement, right? Through dams and through various infrastructure projects that might take place. I want to again reemphasize, and this is not a point of comparison with the West. This ought not to be the only measure by which one assesses the extent, the degree, and how much, in many ways, the relationship between China and African states are reconfigured and consolidated upon patterns or understandings of inequality that one would anticipate would generally be the case, but also how those inequalities are, in some sense, reinforced. So one can look, of course, at the increased revenues that come from the various resources that are generated from FDI. So you have a greater taxation base that can be, in principle, the site for or a source of greater redistribution. It's all contingent, it all depends, and much is lost in the detail. Now, this links obviously to the politics and the polity space that operates for African states as well. And as Christians rightly point out, as others have hinted at, it's not once again a matter of indicating a model that is pre-existing for many African countries and African states, but rather what alternatives are available to, we might say, the popular classes on the ground. So whether it's a reconsolidation of forms of autocracy and authoritarianism, even where that hands-off is allowed for a policy space that was hitherto unavailable previously under neoliberal circumstances, under the liberalization, stabilization and adjustment regimes. One can talk about human rights, one can talk about all these different kinds of things, but I'll leave it there. The final, and I've hinted at this from the outset, from the example of Gambia, of course, is the environment, right? Are Chinese firms operating in unstable ecological and environmental zones? If so, what is the ability of local communities and or the African state, should they be so interested in negotiating with Chinese firms and the Chinese state around these fragile ecological zones? To what extent are there, and this is one area that of course China is a leader, and that is to say looking at renewable resources, to what extent is that kind of technology being introduced into Africa and so on, right? So one could elaborate a mapping of, we might say, what we used to call in our discourse and development, of a certain kind of development that's either intentional or imminent. That is to say, whether the intention to develop leads to consequences that have been part of the pattern of the history of development that many of us no longer find acceptable. The other question is whether within that model of development assistance, across the range of industries, across the sectors of the economy, whether it's agricultural or industry, or whether these trading patterns reinforce an imminence to development that's going to lend itself to the kinds of displacement that we've historically seen in the context of the development so-called that's come from the West. The final point I'm going to make, and this is really throwing it out to all of us here, is the issue of imperialism, right? I don't think China's an imperial power in the sense in which historically we can clearly identify the West as being, whether it's your colonial powers, whether it's the United States, or whether it's new actors that play a role. But that is not really the issue. The real issue about imperialism is in some ways rule by another means, but also consolidating certain facets of inequality. And I'm going to list three, and they're not mine. They come from two Indian economists who may be well known to people here. One is increasing the supply size. So we can ask the question, what is the nature of the supply of commodities that Africa is continuing to maintain? Is it increased? And this gets back to the earlier points, right? As to whether or not that increase increases the value to those African countries. The second, and we've seen this in the context of neoliberalism, which is to say the value of money, right? What is the nature of that value of money? Well, one of the ways in which it's been done through the system of imposed comparative advantage in the context of neoliberal regimes is, of course, to reduce the value of African money, right? And by that, I mean both the currency, but also the overall quanta of revenues from trade. And the third, and for me the most important, is what they call income deflation, which is to say, what is in fact the revenues that are generated for the vast majority of the popular classes in Africa. Imperialism wants to drive down, in fact, the income of most of the constituents, what we would call the popular classes. If any of those three happen, then we've got some matrix of understanding imperialism more than just simply by identifying it through aggregate flows. They in and of themselves don't tell us the nature of imperialism. I would say that broadly speaking, overall, not just the epiphenomenal features, the road in the Congo, perhaps the fish farms in various parts of Africa, but rather the overall effect and impact of trying to understand these three components of these new modes of imperialism. Thank you, everyone. I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Pablo. And again, thank you very much for all the panelists and presenters. A very important point that was made, the general conclusion that we can at least maybe all agree on is that the picture is never black or white, and that there's a need to critically look at the relationship to see what are the benefits, what are the challenges, what are the perspectives. As mentioned, the event today was co-organized by the Manifesto Group and the Toronto chapter of GRILA. For more information about GRILA, you can go to its website. It is grila.org. So a lot of points that were raised within by the presenters, going from a range of ideas regarding Western propaganda machinery that were raised by Daniel at the beginning, the question of militarization and the presence of AFRICOM, the question of infrastructure involvement of China in Africa. And Wang Chang also raised the question of the investment of China in terms of research, the cultural front, lots of examples that were given in different countries, the Chinese study programs, the think tanks, and the long-term collaboration between China, Communist Party, and some movement in the continent like the South African Communist Party. Abuyomi, of course, looked very closely at FOCA, the Forum of China and Africa Relationship, the intervention, and also the migration crisis in Europe as being the result of the situation that was triggered by actions of imperialism in countries like Libya, in Syria, etc. The question of regime change was also addressed by him, and he highlighted very quickly the continuity of the Joe Biden administration in the US in terms of giving the example of the conflict currently in Ethiopia and the Tigray region. He, of course, made this, highlighted the difference on vision of democracy between China and the Western powers, and insisted on the on the front at the situation of the indigenous population in North America, how they've been treated by this country, who so-called calling themselves democratic countries. And the last example he gave also is the state of the black population in the US, victim of centuries of oppression and racial discrimination. Jan and Barry Sarkman also came and talked about is China colonizing Africa? And the answer was no. And they articulated a different, several points relating to the definition of colonialism to try to show that China's involvement in Africa is not based on those characteristics of classical colonialism that we know of. They end up at the end talking about the behavior of China in Africa, the economic partnership, their vision of non-intervention, and also the lack of brain drain when it comes to the relationship between Africa and China comparatively to what's happening between Africa in the West, where most of the human resources are leaving the continent to go to the Western countries. Christine addressed the question of South-South cooperation versus neo-imperialism, and then tried to bring a point about looking into the power relationship, that is the dynamics of power in terms of dealing between Africa and the rest of the world, China being one of them. And then she kind of looked at the question of some Chinese involvement in Africa, and also some good points that that relationship have brought to the table. So, and finally, Pablo just finished with the question of soft power. And then he made a very important point that the West cannot be the model against which to compare other countries in terms of what the way they deal with Africa, because it's not a reference. So it's not enough to just go through the high level numbers and figures of the relationship, but to break it down at a level that can be scrutinized to see what are the weaknesses, what are the benefits, what are the challenges, and what are the risk of such a relationship. So as I mentioned at the end, the relationship is never a black or white situation. There are a lot of situations that are different from country to country. And but there are some constants, which is that Africa is looking for a process of industrialization, and then to break away from the long-term relationship between export of raw materials and also import of manufactured product. That is a fact, that is a reality that African countries no longer want to continue. The question of access to the land also is another question that is important for a lot of Africans. They are saying that the land is not for sale. Investors, whether they're coming from the West or from China, can have access to African land on the condition that needs to be defined by African countries based on their needs. The question of technology transfer also should be very much so taken care of in dealing with China, so that Africa can develop a self-process of continuing and maintaining this infrastructure that have been invested in the African continent. Another point that a lot of people from Africa also are raising is the question of militarization is being having a big impact on the continent. And so I just wanted to summarize it very high level like that.
Vous avez 60 ans ou plus? C'est maintenant le temps de prendre votre rendez-vous pour votre dose de rappel contre la COVID-19. Allez sur québec.ca/vaccin-COVID pour prendre votre rendez-vous en ligne. Pour bien vous protéger contre la COVID-19 et ses variants, vous devez recevoir la dose de rappel et continuer de respecter la distanciation, de porter le masque et de laver vos mains. La dose de rappel, un moyen de nous protéger plus longtemps. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
So this just about wraps it up for us here on Amandla, not only tonight, but for 2021. And whew, boy, what a year. Anyway, it looks like as we enter 2022, it might be a little bit more of what a year. So we are encouraging you all to stay safe and take a deep breath. And hey, let's devote ourselves to bringing down those apartheid walls and actually sharing some of these vaccinations. What do you think, Doug?
I've talked about that plenty this year, and I really do have enormous anger at our government for being so blatantly greedy and selfish and allowing drug companies to get away with outrageous profiteering and the total ignoring of 80% of the world's needs. So we must fight this and we must get at it hard. So stay tuned. I'm sorry, before I do that, I just want to wish everybody a happy new year. It's been a good year for us to, and we managed to get through it quite all right. It's looking like it's starting rock and roll for 2022, but we're going to do it. We're going to make it. We'll get there, ladies and gentlemen. Comrades, you're with us and we're with you. Thank you to CQT for keeping us alive and stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
COVID-19 is quickly circulating throughout the province of Quebec. It's essential that you get tested only if you have COVID-like symptoms. Symptoms such as fever, cough, and loss of taste or loss of smell. As you may already know, testing still remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. For more information, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Ring, 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 CKUT. Yeah. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding, CKUT. 90.3, take it from me. It's the best, beats the rest. 90.3 CKUT.